You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by the United Labor Credit Union and Blake and Ulig, PA. The United Labor Credit Union is the only financial institution around to exclusively serve the Greater Kansas City labor community and the only one endorsed by the Greater Kansas City AFL-CIO. For over 30 years, we've been serving union members in Kansas City and beyond, their family members, and retirees from all crafts. We're here to ensure that your financial future is secure and that you succeed in personal financial growth. To learn more about membership and experience the power of you for yourself, call United Labor Credit Union at 816-313-2848 or visit us online today at unitedlaborcu.org. And Blake and Ulig, advocates for labor for over 40 years, proudly representing organized labor and its members throughout Missouri and Kansas. We thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, does your zip code determine how long you'll live? Find out on tonight's show about a new health report on Wyandotte County. Then, some local history. Before it was KCK, there was a diverse community of Indians, white settlers, and escaped slaves on the banks of the Missouri River. Is there a plan for reconstructing Quindaro? In the news, St. Louis raises its minimum wage, and federal judge busts pilot strike at Spirit Airlines. Our feature at the end of the show is Remember Our Struggle with Ariana Eckel. Now for the news.
Spirit Airlines is known as a cheap airline with no frills. It appears that cheap goes for the compensation of their pilots, too. Meaning, when you fly Spirit, you've got the cheapest pilot in the industry. No wonder the pilots went on strike. PAI reports that Federal District Judge William Demetrius in Florida has ordered Spirit Airlines pilots back to work immediately and barred the bargainers, calling the Master Executive Council, the Airline Pilots Association, ALPA, from defying it. The judge in the case scheduled a hearing on further moves for May 15th and also barred the pilots from continuing any, quote, work stoppage, slowdown, sick out, work of rule campaign, or conceded refusal to fly normally or on overtime. The judge said he needed to bust the strike so that the travel plans of large number of plaintiffs, that is Spirit's customers, wouldn't be disrupted, depriving the public of transportation services. Captain Stuart Morrison, chairman of the Spirit Unit of ALPA, told the union's entire executive council on April 28th, since we started current negotiations in February 2015, the company has made more than $642 million in net profits. While pilots at comparable airlines have seen substantial improvements in compensation, our pilots continue to work under a seven-year-old agreement that puts us well below the industry standard. Morrison said that despite the profits, management is proposing a compensation package that would cement its pilots at the bottom of the industry and offset any increases in pay or benefits with the work rule concessions.
And the New York Times reports that 2 weeks ago, Yale graduate student teachers began a hunger strike to pressure the school to negotiate with their union. Eight students committed to fast, at least until a doctor says their health is at risk of permanent damage. If one student has to stop fasting, another will take their spot. Four of the students have had nothing but water for 14 days as of Tuesday. Yale, like many college and universities, rely on grad students and other low-paid contingent faculty members, like adjunct professors, to teach much of its coursework. Together, they make up about 70% of the teachers in higher education in the U.S. Contingent faculty are poorly paid and lack access to affordable health care, job security, or a voice in their working conditions. So many have turned to unions. But a number of universities, like Yale, are stonewalling them, even though last August the National Labor Relations Board ruled that graduate teachers at private universities are employees and therefore have a right to collective bargaining. Graduate students in eight departments at Yale voted to unionize, seeking better wages and health care, as well as access to a legal grievance process and better accountability for problems like sexual harassment. Yale, however, prefers to union bust. It hired an expensive union busting law firm to harass and intimidate the students. The lawyers argue that graduate students' teaching assistants aren't professionals. Rather, they're apprentices, and virtually anyone could teach their courses. Since Yale parents are paying $50,000 a year for their kids' education, they may be wondering why Yale lets inept graduates teach their kids. It appears that Yale is stalling until President Trump appoints new members to the National Labor Relations Board, because the appointees will almost certainly be anti-union and more likely to overturn the current ruling that graduate teaching assistants are indeed employees. Harvard, Columbia, Duke, New York University, Emory, and Barnard have also hired law firms to undermine the non-tenured teachers.
As of May 5th, St. Louis has finally implemented its minimum wage increase. One of the people who will get the raise is Richard Bouillon, who has been a janitor for 25 years and is a member of the SEIU Local 1. He made $9 an hour and will now earn $10 an hour. Next January, it will go up to $11 an hour. Bouillon stated, too many working people in St. Louis need to take a second job just to keep our head above water. Between bills, food, and rent, there's not much left at the end of the day. We need to make sure working families can make a living, and raising the minimum wage will go a long way towards making that a reality. Janitors, higher education faculty, and public sector workers of the SEIU Local 1 thank Mayor Lydia Crewson for implementing this law. We fought long and hard for this victory. But of course, the Missouri legislature in its dying days doesn't want to leave it at that. Yesterday, Senator Jamila Nasheed, a Democrat from St. Louis, filibustered a bill taking aim at St. Louis's minimum wage for about 2 hours before it was tabled, putting it in jeopardy. House Bill 1194, which we've reported on before, will prevent communities from setting a rate higher than the state's current $7.70 an hour minimum wage. It's already passed the House. Not only is the St. Louis increase in jeopardy, but also Kansas City will vote in August on whether to raise its minimum wage to $13 an hour. Yesterday, the bill was placed on an informal calendar in the Senate where Senator Nasheed filibustered. Since drop dead day is tomorrow, there is hope the Senate won't let go of it. The news tonight was read by Lloyd Danner, Molly Madden, and myself, Aaron Blockman. Everybody, take care of yourself.
Just come to work here. good evening. This is Hester Dusick, CWA 6360, retired. And tonight on the Heartland Labor Forum, we have some very important information for our listeners. It's the HEAT report, the Health Equity Action Transformation. This was, they focused on Wyandotte County. It affects working people, families, and historically, what has happened on with our cities. It was great to understand the pieces. So tonight we have Jerry Jones, the executive director of CHC, and Donna Young and Rachel Jefferson. So tonight I want to start off with Mr. Jones, and can you give us an idea why Wyandotte County was chosen to find out environmentally and everything else as to why our people are more ill and dying?
Yeah, so it's been almost 5 years ago. I was approached by the Reach Healthcare Foundation when I was working for another organization. We had done research in Kansas City, Missouri, and really trying to identify what the emergency room hotspots were. And we generated this report after about 8 months of work. And the Reach Healthcare Foundation was like, we really love the report, but we want to know why Wyandotte County was not included when Wyandotte County has the worst health outcomes of any county within the metro area, and was really challenged by that. You know, I'm third generation Wyandotte Countyan, born and raised there, and I didn't have a good answer. And so they approached me and said, hey, if you had funding, would you be willing to initiate a research project in Wyandotte County? And I'm like, of course, I'd be more than happy to. And that's how it was chosen. It was chosen because, you know, Wyandotte County is, you know, typically, you know, out of 105 counties, we're typically the least healthy county as far as health outcomes. We have the most social economic challenges of any other county in the state. We're also a very, I'd say, very resilient county. I think we're a very culturally diverse county. We're unlike any other county in the state, as far as I'm concerned, in the state of Kansas. And we really wanted to figure out not only, you know, where people go when they get sick, and as Donna will probably talk about later, we really wanted to get to the heart of what's actually making people sick, and that really is what turned the tide, I think, with this particular report.
Well, would you like to just touch on a few of the things that surprised you or were the real hot spots? I know that there are specific areas. You might want to start with where those specific areas are.
Well, and I'd really really love for Rachel to kind of chime in. The thing about this report, you know, it's kind of a sensitive subject, like this whole notion of assessments in general. Even the notion of assessing a community, it feels somewhat elitist. It's typically outsiders coming in and saying, oh, what's happening in this particular community? Even as someone who was born and raised in Wyandotte County, I felt that way. I'd really like kind of Rachel to kind of speak on her experiences being, you know, like representing several different neighborhoods in the community, because her the communities that she's really responsible for and the folks in her community are as you go down the list of vulnerable populations, many of them are in her part of the county. But I don't think it does it justice to say, oh, this is what's like all these, you know, health disparities in these particular areas. But I think it's more about, the people. There are people that are in this report. Whenever I see these numbers, all I'm seeing is people. And so I think to give more of a human element, behind these data points that are lifted up in the report, I think would be really fascinating to highlight.
Well, I think it's important too. I know, Donna, as you spoke to our group, I was losing track sometimes because as you're saying this and this and this and this where, and I'm mentally jumping around going, oh yeah, that's where so-and-so lives. And oh yeah, that's where this or that was. And it was that human element. And it wasn't, and it was just a surprise. It was a surprise of a lot of things that we had ignored. What would you like to add, Rachel?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. My organization, the Historic Northeast Midtown Association, as Jerry said, represents a lot of neighborhood associations and businesses in the Northeast area, a lot of whom have experienced the disinvestment and lack of opportunity that's highlighted in the HEAT report. I would say for us, it was not a surprise. The data and the evidence that came out in the HEAT report, if anything, it really supported what we already knew about our community, that there was strong historical evidence to support that the reasons why we were experiencing the disinvestment, the health inequity, are not fantastical reasons. They are really based in policies and planning and have been quite strategic in separating our society into different segments of populations and picking and choosing the winners of our society. So when the HEAT report came out, I think what it did for us is it allowed us to put some technical terms and some data behind what many of my neighborhood association presidents already knew and were already living with. And so that's what's great about it is it has empowered the neighborhood people, given them the power to speak to staff and administration in these institutions in ways that they understand in order to influence the policy and start making planning decisions that will start to change desperate situations in which we're living in the Northeast area.
I have a question. It says here that the Ohio State University Kerwin Institute for Study of Race and Ethnicity was the entity that did the study. Is that correct? How were they chosen?
So I had a prior relationship working with the folks at the Kerwin Institute. I'd mentioned we'd done a similar study for Kansas City, Missouri, back in 2011. I had originally worked out with them that, you know, they had this methodology on really determining like what the level of health opportunity was. The funders were happy with their work. I was happy with their work. And their founder, Dr. John Powell, is one of the, you know, forethought leaders on dealing with challenges as it relates to race, inclusion, exclusion, and really helping. He really helped me to form my initial vocabulary on how to have discussions on race in a predominantly white society as an African American male. And so when we had the opportunity to explore just the depth of health disparities in Wyandotte County, we wanted to work, continue that work with the Kerwin Institute.
Right, and who can best explain the redlining effect? Because I, too, raised in Wyandotte County multiple generations, and I'm going, I kind of know something about redlining, but I didn't think about it. So who would like to explain how that affected people's ability to prosper and their health?
So I'll jump in. This is Donna. I have to start just by saying that redlining really was initiated in the earliest part of the century. So after the Great Depression, a lot of folks were losing their homes, not all that different from the recession we just recently have come through. And as folks began to lose their homes, there was an effort made to ensure loans for refinancing so individuals could keep their homes. And the federal government worked to identify a group of people to assess these areas, and that was the Homeowners Loan Corporation. And as these assessments were done, the Homeowners Loan Corporation would take a look at broad areas, specifically broad neighborhoods, to identify risk factors. And they would grade these neighborhoods based off of the descriptions of those neighborhoods, based off what the assessors were able to identify. The HOLC process is different than the process we see today. Today, if you want to refinance your home, we take a look at the house, the property, and we take a look at your credit history, and we take a look at the surrounding properties. The way that HOLC assessed the neighborhoods was on the entire neighborhood. So it didn't matter what your home looked like. It didn't matter what your credit history was. It didn't matter really how much effort you put into maintaining your property. If you lived in a predominantly Black neighborhood, you were more likely to be rated as a D risk factor, which means that you would not be eligible for a home refinancing loan. And as we go through the process in the report and identifying how those assessments were done, we took a look at historical documents that HOLC used to describe the neighborhoods that were ranked A, B, C, and D. When we looked at the narrative portion of these descriptions on these documents, what we found was language that really supported a true systemic racialized process for identifying who could get a loan. And if you can imagine what it's like, lots of people today even know, when you are in a situation and your home is being foreclosed on and you really just desperately want to keep your home and all your worldly possessions, a lot hinges on being able to keep your home. And so for this organization, this whole organization, to make a decision based primarily on race, based off the narrative, the word Negro was the most commonly used word in the narrative. We know it was racial. It's something that has led to the communities that we see today. And so when we see people who are dying 20 years earlier than their neighbors 5 miles down the road, when we see people who are dying from cancer, people who are losing babies twice as frequently before the first birthday, all of those factors, we know they're concentrated in these red line neighborhoods because of systemic disinvestment, because of individuals who over the course of decades have lost their wealth and their access to resources.
We have also lost some hospitals because we closed St. Margaret's, and Bethany now, I understand Bethany now has some health care things in it, whether it's for the veterans or for children. We just don't have a lot of good, in my knowledge is limited, but it just looks like there are fewer, just the same way there are fewer grocery stores. When I went to one of the breakfasts that the mayor had, it was like, oh, we need more grocery stores. And I very smugly thought, well, we had. And I drove past her and, oh, my God, Charlie Ball's has turned into an auto parts store. And then, the A&P has now turned into a Hispanic variety store. And the other, I mean, I just went everywhere. I'm going, oh, my gosh, what has happened to my city? And it did it quietly. I'm really, really concerned about the infant mortality. What steps are there to be taken to correct that or any of these problems?
Well, both of our organizations works closely with the Unified Government Health Department. They have a department in there called Healthy Communities Wyandotte, which just had its 5th year anniversary last year. And they have several different committees that work on some of these issues that we were discussing, all of which compound into bad health. And so they have infrastructure action team, nutrition action team, and then they also have a fetal infant mortality team. And that team's been working for about the last 2 years looking at ways that they can decrease the fetal infant mortality rate in Wyandotte County. Everything from working with service providers, doctors, their offices, making sure they're aware of resources that are already existing in the community that they can refer their clients to, trying to find out from the state insurance perspective, why mothers are not able to get insurance or not being able to be seen by a doctor until they have that insurance card in their hand. There's a lot of bureaucracy that can sometimes gum up the system, but there are a lot of good people doing work in Wyandotte County trying to really attack these issues from a thoughtful and systemic point of view. And so those are some of the organizations and the different committees that are at work at this and always looking for more people who have a passion for the community and want to make an impact.
Well, Donna hooked me because when she spoke, it was like, yes, I do want to be a part of this. And even though for whatever reasons we've moved to a different part of the city, that doesn't mean we don't still have the passion for Wyandotte County.
Right.
And an IBM salesman one time told me that his experience was Wyandotte County women get out of their way because they will not stop. Is there, what specifically, the lead paint came to mind as I remember picking the stuff off the wall. My brother, when I told my brother, he says, well, that explains a lot. And so, because I'd sit there trying to go to sleep. What can be done about that? I mean, that and other things, because I guess it's the older housing market that creates some serious problems. Who has the best knowledge of that?
So in the county, the way that we look at the information is we look at the assessed value of the home, and we cross-reference that with the age of the home. And so what we know is that if it's an older home built before 1978, it would be most likely to have contained lead paint during construction. And if it's of a lower value, typically that means it hasn't been renovated. And so those homes are more likely to have a lead paint hazard. And so what we know is about 49% of the homes, parcels in the county are at risk, moderate to high risk, in fact, for lead paint exposure. Majority of those homes, of that 49%, are in the northeast portion, the northeast quadrant of the county. One of the things that we are currently working with multiple different agencies on is to understand what is the system currently today, how is it being monitored, what does the surveillance look like, and what can we do as a community coming together, a community of stakeholders, to identify resources to begin to remediate those lead concerns. There are a lot of best practices parents can do, making sure that they are really exercising hand washing, making sure that they're keeping their home dust free, because a lot of the lead paint from the windows will get into the environment and end up in the spaces where our children are. And that lead paint hazard is really devastating to small children. And so it's important to make sure that we're taking care of the homes the best way possible while we continue to work on opportunities for helping residents in the community address those internal indoor air quality issues.
Well, Mr. Jones, I have my favorite areas to focus on. Can you tell me what you think is the most important thing that will improve the health and longevity of the people in those areas?
You know, everything that we're talking about is the product of decades of discrimination and disinvestment. And really, those things really formed a design by which neighborhoods and people that live in those neighborhoods are trapped, in a sense, to all the things that are listed in the report, things that both Rachel and Donna have lifted up. Really, the choice that's before really the county, you know, really the unified government and the people of Wyandotte County, and I'd say really the metro as a whole, and thinking about Wyandotte County, in the same way that there was an intentional design that ultimately created the environment that folks are living in now, we have to take a systemic and strategic approach to undo. Like, so if redlining is the expression of systemic racism, then the expression of undoing that would be a robust community-led investment. Mm-hmm. Right now, we know that the county is considering a master plan for the Northeast. I feel like one of the best ways to ensure that the plan is done correctly is to partner with Rachel and other folks from the community to ensure that the plan is actually what the people desire. And then I think second on top of that is there has to be a robust commitment from the unified government to fund the plan. No more unfunded mandates. There has to be, you know, I think about the STAR bonds that just recently matured. I'd say the best way is for the unified government to reimagine and say, hey, those STAR bonds matured. We're going to invest that into the neighborhoods that have been systemically disinvested over the past 100 plus years and figure out another way to pay for the other stuff. That to me would be the best way.
We're going to consider this part one because we could go on for a long, long time. And this report just came out, what, October 2016?
Correct.
Okay. So there hasn't been a lot of time to act on it yet. So I'm going to invite you back. We can get an update on what's done and what you need help with. And I want to thank Jerry Jones, Executive Director for Community Health Council. And Donna Young, you are the project manager?
Correct.
Okay. And Rachel Jefferson, you're with Northeast. It's a long name.
Historic Northeast Midtown Association.
It will surely be one of my favorites. Is there anything specifically in the next couple seconds you'd like to say for people to do?
Yes, we would love for everyone who's interested in this report to go to wearewyandotte.com. You'll be able to find a video summary. Thank you, Rachel, for being our spokesperson for that, along with videos that highlight the work that's currently taking shape in our community. You can download the report for free. We also have a comic book that is amazing. The artwork's fantastic. That's also available for free download. We are inviting the community into discussion, and so if you have an interest in this information, we are going to different sessions, sharing the information. Definitely reach out to us through the website. Let us know that you're interested.
Thank you all for being here. I really appreciate it, and I know that we are all together going to make a difference for Wyandotte County.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank
you. This week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Contrary to the myth in our culture that we're separated and individual, aggressive, competitive creatures, we're actually wired for empathy, wired for connection, wired for love, wired for compassion.
I'm Neil Harvey. Please join us for Inner Resilience with Dr. Gabor Mate on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
That's Friday morning at 9:30.
Hello, my name is Joseph Jackson. Join me on Thursday, May 11th at 7 p.m. for the pilot episode of Cowtown Conversations. Our guest will be the project manager of the Prospect Max Line, Kansas City's next rapid transit line. It will transform Prospect and the neighborhoods surrounding it. Tune in to find out more on this exciting project on Cowtown Conversations, Thursday, May 11th at 7 p.m. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
There's a man, homeless and hungry. There's a wind that's hard and biting. There's a song in need of singing. There's a fuse in need of lighting. And it's no secret, the day is coming, and it's a day I hope to see. But if they ask, if they ask you, brother, who told you that, you didn't hear it from me. Let freedom ring, let freedom ring. Let freedom ring, let freedom ring. There's a book with seven seals. There's a beast with seven heads. There's seven angels.
This is Jacob White, and I am speaking with Liz Hobson. Liz, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah.
Liz is the Education and Interpretation Manager of Freedom's Frontier. And Liz, just for people who are maybe new to the area or who haven't been to any of your guys' programs and sites, could you tell us a little bit about Freedom's Frontier?
Sure. Freedom's Frontier is a national heritage area, and we are 41 counties in eastern Kansas and western Missouri. We're actually one of 49 different heritage areas across the country. And so that just means that Congress has actually designated this 41-county region as being nationally significant. So what we do as a heritage area is we work to build awareness for the struggles for freedom in western Missouri and eastern Kansas. These are really important stories that kind of started in this region that really shaped the country. So what we do is we offer our resources. We work with a lot of different museums and historic sites, libraries, schools, nature preserves, and convention and visitors bureaus. So we work with all of these different partners in working to better tell these stories. We focus on three different themes. So we focus on shaping the frontier and the border war of Kansas and Missouri and the Civil War and the enduring struggle for freedom.
One of the reasons that I was interested in speaking to someone from Freedom's Frontier about the most recent projects is I went to the April 22nd Earth Day walking tour of one of your guys' sites, which is the site we're going to talk about today, the Quindaro Ruins. And it was just really an incredible day. The weather was perfect and there were a ton of people out there. But it did seem like there were some things that if the site had, you know, some more recognition and some more funding, that there might be able to be some improvements. So could you talk a little bit about some of the improvements you guys are looking to do and some of the methods and some of the ways that you're going about trying to get those funded?
Sure. So we have a lot of different partners, but the ones in Quindaro are they're really special, and we've really enjoyed working with them. There's several different museums in the Quindaro area, but even more past that, there's a lot of community members who are really dedicated to these stories. And as you probably experienced on your walking tour, there's a lot of different layers to the Quindaro story. And that's what we've kind of been involved with from the start. We started working with Quindaro and our stakeholders there in 2015. And that was when the Rivers, Trails, and Conservation Assistance Program of the Park Service led a meeting in Quindaro and kind of started the discussion on what we could do or what the stakeholders could do to really preserve what was out there. So we got involved then, and since then just kind of been working with the community on different projects that can really not only preserve what's out there, but start to gather up all of the histories, all of the many different histories that are there, compile them for future generations. So one of them that one of the projects that we've been working on is an oral history project. And we've been partnering with the Kansas City, Kansas Public Library. And we had our first one in February. We worked with the library and we just said, we'll set up some recorders and some digital recorders in the library on a Saturday. And we'll see if anybody wants to come in and record their stories. And we were really excited when we had, I think it was 9 different people come in, and they had all of these great stories about either growing up in Quindaro, you know, in the last 50 years, having stories of going down to the ruins, and also those really significant stories about people's ancestors, you know, the freedom seekers coming in and members of the Wyandotte Nation. So we thought that was a huge success, and it not only started connecting more of the community members to what we were doing, but also starting this repository of these histories that we can later have in some kind of website or in the library that students and community members can go and read. So we've been working on the oral history project, and we're having our second one on Saturday, May 20th, and that will be at the Kansas City, Kansas Public Library, right there in downtown Kansas City, Kansas, on Minnesota Avenue. And we're scheduled from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. And we are open again to any community member who wants to come out, and you don't have to live in Quindaro now. We've even had some people call who grew up, you know, in Quindaro in the 1940s, still have memories, and they live, you know, hours away now. So so there's ways that we can work with that too. So we're just hoping that this really does start gathering up these stories. So when there is a museum or an interpretive center that can really show off these great things, that we have a lot to put in there. Another project that we've been working on is uplifting what is currently a National Register nomination. So the area of the ruins, the town site, that is actually on the National Register for Historic Places. And that protects the area, and that deems it significant on a local level. And what we are working on currently is uplifting that to a National Historic Landmark. And there are fewer National Historic Landmarks than there are National Register nominated properties in the country. And that would actually deem this area significant on a national level, which would give some great exposure to Quindaro and really help with grant, you know, receiving grants, and really help with this awareness.
Is that part of the plan? Is that really specifically about the township that's sort of started in 1857, or is that going to be about the, you know, the whole history from then until now?
Well, the National Historic Landmark, if it is uplifted to a National Historic Landmark, that would actually entail just the area that is currently on the National Register nomination. And that's going to focus mainly on that the old town site of 1857 and the ruins that are currently there. That's not to say that the area surrounding that, we've had conversations with a lot of community members that have properties that aren't currently on any National Register, So we can certainly work with those individuals in protecting and preserving their properties. But at this time, that landmark status would focus on that 1857 area.
And from these oral histories that you've been getting, you mentioned people from all the way back in the 1940s. Has that opened up any new information about how the site has changed in that time? I know when I went, Marvin Robinson III was our tour guide, and he talked a lot about the pipelines and the fact that they wanted to make it a landfill for a while. So have you learned more about the environmental history of the area from the Oral History Project?
Absolutely. Yes. And that's what is another layer that I find just so fascinating, because the history of the town itself, what we're talking about, that 1857 history, that's significant, but so is the story of the preservation and the changing landscape and the community members like Marvin getting involved to change things. So, yeah, we've been receiving a lot of the history of the preservation and how it's kind of shaped throughout time to what it is today from that town site in 1857.
So the goal would be to have a permanent structure with some air conditioning or something like that would really tell the story of the township. Could you tell us just a little bit of the story of the township?
Yeah, and I can't speak for what the end result will be, because I think there's just so much out there, and there's so many, so if it is a permanent structure, that could be it. But at this time, we don't have any kind of clear outlook on what that can be. There's a lot of options for what it can be. The town site kind of started in 1857. It was settled by Wyandotte Indians and the white abolitionists coming from New England and business owners. And then you also had the freedom seekers coming in from Missouri. So this kind of community really did, to me, reflect a lot of what was going on in a greater sense in 19th century America. And that's what's just so interesting about this. It was right seated on the Missouri River. And so it was also a port town. It was one of the, I believe it was the only free state port town during that time. So it was a very busy, bustling city for a time. There's also the story, I mean, Clarina Nichols settled there. She was from New England, settled there, and worked for the newspaper. So there's a story of women's rights thrown into this already so significant and multifaceted story of history. So the town site was successful. It was booming for a time. And then it did have a decline, you know, after the Civil War began to decline. And then the question marks kind of for me, and I'm definitely not the expert on Quindaro history, the town site history, but it did have a decline, and then kind of there wasn't as much of a need for that port town, so it people left, and it kind of wasn't as bustling anymore, and ended up being what it is today.
We've been talking with Liz Hobson. She's the Education and Interpretation Manager at Freedom's Frontier. The second session of the Quindaro Oral History Project is set for 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. on May 20th at the Kansas City, Kansas Public Library. And if you know anything about the Quindaro Project, they might be interested in finding out more from you. What other plans do you guys have for the information that you get from the Oral History Project?
Well, we're actually working with several of our stakeholders on a Quindaro Symposium that will be in April of 2018. And if you're interested in learning more from the historians out there who are researching Quindaro, from the community members who are doing art projects and have a lot to share, come out in April of 2018 and really get to know it. We're trying to compile all of those stories together so that they're preserved.
Liz, just to take things away from the Quindaro Project and more broadly about your guys' organization, I guess it is mostly in Kansas City. So I guess maybe this is a question that will, you know, play to your own biases and things, but this is supposed to be a nice weekend in Kansas City. If you could recommend for families here one site from Freedom's Frontier to go visit this weekend, what do you think?
One site. That's really hard
I'm
to
sorry.
Do. well, I'm a fan of our outdoor sites in both Kansas and Missouri. So I know that Poplar Heights Living History Farm up in Butler, Missouri. They have a great new exhibit about textiles, and I think it's a great time to go out and see some of the farming that they have there, too, just because it is that time for planting. And then if you're on the Kansas side, you can always head out to Mahaffey Stagecoach Stop in Olathe. They also are doing that planting, so it's a great time to get out there and see it, and what's great about some of these sites is that they'll let the visitors jump right in and help as well. So get out there and get to work.
All right, that's very interesting. So thank you so much for joining us, and we really wish you guys the best of luck, and if you haven't been out to the Quindaro site yet, it's worth the visit. So Liz, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Good evening and welcome to Remember Our Struggle. I'm Ariana Eckel. Imagine working on a film with unrestricted hours, no enforced turnaround, and no required meal breaks. Imagine working under a 7-year contract that you cannot break and more than likely will be forced to renew. For a producer who can tell you who you can marry, what your morals must be, even what political opinions to hold. This was Hollywood for actors in 1933 under the studio system. Rebel against the studio and you were in for a hard time. Better to quit while you're ahead. Fortunately, a group of actors risked their careers to start the Screen Actors Guild. Studio boss Irving Thalberg swore he would die before accepting the guild. In 1936, Thalberg died, and in 1937, the studios accepted defeat and signed a contract with the guild that for the first time in Hollywood gave actors a sense of empowerment. But the road to empowerment did not end in 1937. While the guild had won actors better working conditions, the studio still basically owned their stars, as there was a tacit agreement among studios not to rate each other for a star's services at their contract's ends. Actors were not able to choose their roles, which is crucial in building a career. Help came, however, in the form of two actresses who were no longer willing to accept the absolute power of the studios over their destiny, Bette Davis and Olivia de Havilland. Bette Davis, tired of the inappropriate roles Warner forced on her, rebelled and was suspended without pay. When Warner issued an injunction against her working anywhere else, Davis sued and lost, but a rebellious precedent had been set. After her triumph in Gone with the Wind, 1939, Mrs. Havilland also rebelled for better roles and was put on a 6-month suspension, and even Warner's refused to release her from her 7th-year contract at the end of its term by claiming that the term of her suspension should be added on to her contract. She sued and won in the landmark de Havilland decision, opening up to negotiation the studio's term contract. A few years later, in 1948, the Supreme Court dealt another fatal blow to the studios in its antitrust Paramount decree, ordering that the motion picture industry be broken up, clearing the way for independents to enter the industry. Suddenly, actors had the power to control their own careers. When Jimmy Stewart negotiated to work on Winchester 73 in 1950 for a percentage of gross receipts, he set a precedent for star deal power that is still in force today. While there was reason to rejoice at the empowerment stars enjoyed with the dissolution of the studio system, for the non-star contract players, risk and insecurity were the inevitable side effects. Today, the freedom and power for stars brought about by the demise of the studio system is evident in the fact that most stars have their own production companies, becoming, in essence, their own mini-studios. The actor who produces, directs, initiates his or her own projects is no longer a phenomenon, but instead is an accepted part of the industry. But for those actors who pound the pavement to act, who choose not to direct or produce, who do not have the option of becoming their own studios, what does SAG offer in this increasingly complex and diversified industry that, with technological advances, morphs almost daily? In an industry with unemployment rates that remain shocking, how does SAG continue on its track of empowering its members? First and foremost, members have to be empowered by knowing their rights. Today, SAG actors head for the set armed with contracts that respond to the exigencies of new technology and the diversity of membership. Unfortunately, there is a tendency on the part of actors working under these contracts to allow producers to bend the rules and exploit them. Self-empowerment is built into guild contracts. Violating them simply dilutes that power for every other member. From winning the basic human necessities of decent working conditions in 1937 to fostering the growth of the actor as an individual in the face of 21st century technology, the Guild has empowered its members by fulfilling its dual capacity of nurturing employment opportunities while maintaining an active vigilance in member protection. When freed from the confines and protection of the studio system, actors were left with the responsibility to control their own destinies. With SAG as a guardian, and sometimes an avenging angel, the studio system void is being filled today with actors who have more tools and opportunities for self-empowerment than ever before. This article was abridged from SAG's website. You have been listening to Remember Our Struggle. I am Ariana Eckel. Have a great evening.
This week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Contrary to the myth in our culture that we separated an individual, aggressive, competitive creatures, we're actually wired for empathy, wired for connection, wired for love, wired for compassion.
I'm Neil Harvey. Please join us for Inner Resilience with Dr. Gabor Mate on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
That's Friday morning at 9:30.
Hello, my name is Joseph Jackson. Join me on Thursday, May 11th at 7 p.m. for the pilot episode of Cowtown Conversations. Our guest will be the project manager of the Prospect Max Line, Kansas City's next rapid transit line. It will transform Prospect and the neighborhoods surrounding it. Tune in to find out more on this exciting project on Cowtown Conversations, Thursday, May 11th at 7 p.m. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Did you know that you can donate that unwanted car, boat, truck, or motorcycle to KKFI and get a tax deduction for your donation? Find out more by calling 866-628-2277.
Every day we tell you about violence.
Here in our city and across the country.
Today we stand together.
No to violence.
We say no to bullying.
We are young and old.
Black.
White.
Multicultural.
We are one.
We are united.
Because in Kansas City,
we don't accept violence.
Not here, not now.
Not ever.
Today we start a movement.
Together we are Kind KC.
Brought to you by Channel 41 and KKFI.
And this is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar for May 11, 2016. Union members invited to join a press conference hosted by the Kansas City AFL-CIO, Friday, May 12, 8:30 a.m. at KCI Airport Terminal A. Constituent Town Hall for Kevin Yoder, i.e., he's invited to talk about his vote to repeal the ACA. That's Friday, May 12, 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. Overland Park Christian Church, 76 West 75th Street, Overland Park, Kansas, 66204. Sponsored by Indivisible KC. Hope everybody joins. Join Stand Up KC and 10,000 others at the McDonald's shareholder meeting in Chicago. Buses leave from 38th and Troost at 11 p.m. Monday, May 22nd, and return late evening May 24th. They're going to march on Chicago McDonald headquarters and then the McDonald's downtown and finally Trump Tower. I know everybody wants to march on Trump Tower. Call standupkansascity.org or find them on Facebook. And check out the Heartland Labor Forum schedule on heartlandlaborforum.org where you can also listen to today's show.
That's it for the Heartland Labor Forum this week. Tune in next week. Our show is called Hate Has No Home Here. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.